I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:33 p.m. on Tuesday, January 27th, 2026. Present today are Representative Hannon, Representative Moore, Representative Bynum, Representative Galvin, and the three co-chairs, Co-Chair Schrage, Co-Chair Foster, and myself, Co-Chair Josephson. Also present today are House Finance Committee staff, Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah-Lastufka, Secretary Bree Wiley, and Secretary Leah Frazier. We also have moderator Emily Mesh with us from the Legislative Information Office. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. In today's meeting, we will introduce and have our first hearing on House Bill 283, titled Appropriations Supplemental, followed by invited testimony. Then we will have the Legislative Finance Division present its overview of the governor's FY27 budget. We're joined by Representative Stapp. First on the agenda is House Bill 283. My staff, Ken Alper, is prepared to present on the committee bill. Mr. Alper, please come forward. Put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper, staff to yourself, Representative Josephson, and the House Finance Committee. What you have before you today, Mr. Chairman, is a committee bill introduced under the name of the Finance Committee. However, these are all governor's items. When Governor Dunleavy introduced his fiscal plan, his budget in December and January, the supplemental items, the items that take effect during the current fiscal year between that solve needs between now and June, were all embedded within his regular operating and capital budgets. He did not have a standalone supplemental budget. And based on input from the construction industry and others, you felt there was a need to get a supplemental budget moving sooner, moving ahead so that these items could be pinned down and funded earlier. So the decision was made to pull those items from the governor's bills, the operating and capital budget, out and create a separate bill with just the supplemental, introduce it as a separate committee bill, and try to make it into something of a fast track. So that's the broad background. There's not that many things here. The spreadsheet on the screen, which members have had since yesterday, the public as well, is what is in this bill, House Bill 283, and I'm happy to go through them and then how they're funded and where they sort of tie into other legislation that they, should this bill pass, obviously they would be removed from amended versions of the other budget bills. So, and the first thing in this bill, Mr. Chairman, is that it's intended to provide a funding source for the known budget deficit for things that have already passed. You might recall when the budget passed at the end of the prior legislative session, there was an expectation of a surplus. Even after the governor's vetoes and then the overrides that occurred in August, we were expecting about $130 million more in revenue than we had in known expenditures. But then when the fall revenue forecast came out, there was about $180 million shift in revenue, taking us from a 130 surplus to what's now a known $51 million deficit based on the forecast revenue numbers from last month. So this bill would fund those. And then we go into the individual items. Now, when I say everything here is from the governor's budgets, there's one exception, and that's the first item on the list. Sections 1 through 3, the number section operating of this bill, is a Medicaid line item that came to us in a report from the Department of Health. It's a relatively precise number. It's the known shortfall in state match to the Medicaid program. To put this in context, Mr. Chairman, it's about the largest program in the state budget, $700 and some million in general fund, close to $2 billion overall, the rest of it federal. And based on what they know at the Department of Health, this is going to be short by $36.4 million. Based on the testimony of the OMB director, this is the number that you expect to see in the next round of governor's supplemental proposals that will be coming to the committee next week, but it was not in the governor's budgets as introduced in December. So that's one thing that we, your committee, have added to this bill. The rest of the line items, and I'm happy if people need to interrupt and ask questions as we go throughout at your discretion. There's only six or eight items here. The next item in sections 4 through 6 is the item that's probably had the most coverage, the most press associated with it. That is the federal DOT matching funds, mostly for the highway program. This replaces money that was originally appropriated last year through reappropriations that the governor vetoed. So there's this gap out there. And that $70 million represents matching funding for up to what could be $700 million in federal construction funding, that the hope is to have that money pinned down so that the contracts could be let and that work could be done in the coming construction season. And you could see that funding in sections 4 through 6 of the bill.
Mr. Alper, I'm going to do some housekeeping. Representative Allard and Representative Tomaszewski have joined us. Representative Colomb is with us in the gallery. Please continue if there's more.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Galvin, question for Mr. Alper.
Quick question, please, regarding the line item that you just covered. So it's 69.695. And you mentioned hope to be 700 million. Are you referring then it's a 10-to-1 match? I just want to make sure I understand that.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, most of these highway programs, as I understand it, it's actually a 90-to-10 match. So whatever we put in would leverage 9 times that amount in federal funding.
Okay, thank you.
Anything more, Mr. Alper?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is after I'm done presenting the underlying bill, you have invited testimony from the contracting and construction industry that could speak with a lot more detail on the need and urgency of this particular line item. The next item on the bill is what you call a reapprope. It's taking a previous appropriation that has some leftover funding in it and using it as a match for a U.S. Department of Energy state energy program. It's $650,000. It's not new money, but it's something that the governor put in his capital budget as a supplemental item, and we simply pulled it out when we were doing a fairly comprehensive job of moving the supplemental items to this new bill and put it in here. Section 8 in the bill, and it's – what page is that? It's page 8 of the bill itself, are the fund capitalization sections of $40 million to the Disaster Relief Fund. This is the governor's number. This is what we believe is the need for the rest of this year. There's other Disaster Relief Fund appropriations in the underlying operating budget that will be FY27 money. Obviously, there's some large disasters in the past interim. The Typhoon Halong, et cetera, that'll have a lot of cost associated with it. And Alexei Painter, when he speaks later, can go into much more nuanced detail than me on the nature and timing of that funding and how it works with federal disaster money and that sort of thing. But there's a lot of moving parts with disasters. The next line item is the Fire Suppression Fund. This one is a little bit unusual just because there's a little bit of inconsistency in how the administration's information came to the committee. On the one hand, their public totaling of the supplemental need, the fiscal summaries, the tables, include the assumption that there's a $55 million fire suppression expenditure. And by and large, Mr. Chairman, that money has been spent, that this is money that there was a disaster declaration related to fires over the summer. The money has been spent under the terms of the disaster declaration. And so we just need to appropriate it. We need to cover for the fact that the money has actually been spent. But the governor didn't put that $55 million line item in his actual budget. Our understanding, at least at the beginning of session and leading into that, was that they intended to use ratification, a little bit different mechanism. I don't know if that's still their intent, but based on the guidance we got from legislative finance and historic practice of the legislature, we thought it would be best to put it in the budget as a line item to make it clear that we are capitalizing the fire suppression fund to meet its needs and to meet what, frankly, has already been expended, so far as we know, $55 million. The next line items are related to the oil and hazardous release prevention and response funds. These are the items that handle spill cleanup and spill response, and they're funded through a couple of small taxes, both the so-called nickel a barrel surcharge on oil production from the North Slope, as well as the slightly less than 1 cent per gallon tax on refined fuels that's administered as part of the motor fuel tax at the Department of Revenue. The way those work mechanically is that the money comes in over the course of the year, and then at the end of the year, there's an appropriation that moves it into these management funds within that are at the Department of Environmental Conservation. It's a routine activity. It's always a supplemental item. And so we moved it into this bill rather than leaving it in the operating budget because, again, it's a supplemental item. There's no new money here. It's all revenue that we are already receiving, and it's simply putting it in its statutorily designated place because we can't have dedicated funds. It requires an overt act of the legislature to put that money where it belongs every year. The next line item, 9C of the bill, is a large fund transfer to refill the Higher Education Investment Fund. Now, this is the fund that's an endowment that funds programs such as performance scholarships, the WAMI program, but it has, when it's full, about $400 million in it, and its income funds these various essential education programs. That was used as a fund source at the end of fiscal year 25, last year, to balance the supplemental budget because there was not another funding source made available. Many have said, including the governor, the other body, the House leadership, that there's a desire to refill that fund. We now know the number. The number is slightly less than $130 million, and this bill refills the higher education fund so that it brings it up to its full amount so that we don't have recurring overdraws, bringing down its balance in the years to come as we fund the programs. So all of that adds up to just under $382.3 million. Now, the number that you might have seen back when the governor was introducing his budget was 346. 346, and again, that's really 294 of new stuff in the budget plus 51 of the deficit that we're filling that we already know about is 346. To that, we added the roughly $36 million in Medicaid, which was a known incoming number, to get to the 382. And the way that we're proposing to fill this in House Bill 283 is with the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. That is the same way that the governor was looking to do this. He had worded it a little bit different, structured it slightly differently, and his only added up to $280 million. Really, the $246 that was in the bill plus a little bit of what they call headroom. We don't have any headroom in this budget. By adding the Medicaid, we went slightly over the 380 to 382 and then put a cap in this budget of right at the 382. So it would require the three-quarter vote for the Constitutional Budget Reserve to fund all of these items when this bill would get to final passage. Mr. Chairman, that is what is in House Bill 283, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, one thing I want to clarify on is that you said there was $294 million of new stuff. It's really not new stuff. It's just not red ink.
Thank you. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, by new stuff, I mean newer than what was in last year's budget. The 51 is last year's budget that's already passed. The 293 are the line items that I just introduced that are in front of you here that are needs that were identified by the governor, and then plus the 36 of Medicaid, which is the new one.
Rep. Tomaszewski.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair, you mentioned the Higher Education Fund, the $129 million that was withdrawn to balance the budget last go-around. Now, you said something interesting when you said you didn't want to see we didn't want to see reoccurring withdrawals from this fund. Has that ever been have we ever used that fund before to balance a budget?
Mr. Heller.
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, let me try to rephrase that. I didn't intend it to be taken that way. What I meant to say was there is this demand on the earnings and the proceeds of the fund for the programs, the performance scholarships, education grants, WAMI, that are based on what the fund is expected to produce when it has $400 million in it. If there's only $270 million in it, its earnings out there in the market are going to be less than the annual demand, and that means every year we'll be taking more out than we're putting back in through earnings, and gradually the value of the fund will be eroded. And that's what this refilling is intended to prevent.
And just follow up.
Follow up.
So thank you. Through the chair, so has that fund ever been used in the way it was used last year?
Through the chair, Rep. Tomaszewski, no, it has not. This was the first time, at least to my knowledge, that this had ever happened.
Okay, thank you.
It was swept away once, however.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. That's an important. over the years, and you yourself have been in the middle of these debates, the question of what is subject to the so-called CBR sweep at the end of every fiscal year under Section 17D. In past years, there was a year, I think it was 2020 or 2021, where the so-called reverse sweep vote didn't happen and the higher education fund was wiped for a period of months. And then in the next session, it was reconstituted to its full amount. Actually, it must have been 2021 because it was the 2022 session that we had surpluses and high oil prices, and we conveniently had enough cash to be able to do that year.
But it apparently was an important enough priority to that legislature to recapitalize.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. It was close to $400 million that was put back into the fund in 2022.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Mr. Alper, my question has to do with Section 5, the DOT match, and on page 6 of the bill as drafted. When we look at that item, we've got the 69.695 match money. And then we also have $459,000 in receipts. So I just want to make sure, and I understand we're not appropriating $459 of UGF, but if someone were to, say, have a fiscal note to the bill, this $459,000 is going to show on there. So I want to make sure that you have articulated on the record that is not, because we're looking at your summary sheet, and if we're matching the sections, the totals would be different because it doesn't mention the program receipts. And I want to also verify that those program receipts aren't they dependent on that match money being allocated?
Mr. Upper.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I don't know that I can answer all of those questions as 100%. I will say you're looking at Section 5. Let's back up a page to page 5 to Section 4, which has a little bit more detail on the line items there. And you can see the reason it's in two separate places is the $69.9 million, the larger number, is what they're calling federal program match, the sort of 9-to-1 share going to the federal appropriations, versus the smaller number, which they're calling statewide federal programs, which also is matching to federal funds, but it might require someone from DOT or maybe Mr. Painter to explain the nuance of the difference. We took it the way it was written in the governor's budget. I do want to call out through the chair that the summary sheet does have both numbers on it. If you look at the spreadsheet, the third number down is the 69.6, and then the fourth number down is that 459,000 number.
Okay. So follow up, but I guess it's more of a statement of, I guess we'll look to Mr. Payne to explain it because, of course, we have heard the federal match being restored via supplemental and the governor is a $70 million and sometimes the $69 million. And if the difference is these program receipts, if it needs to be part of the supplemental, I want it there so that we are maximizing our federal match. But if it's not a supplemental, if it's just ongoing receipts, then it inflates how much we're putting in the supplemental bill.
Well, I see Mr. Painter has...
And we can wait till he's there to present.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as Mr. Upper said, this was identified as a supplemental in the operating budget, House Bill 264. Mr. Painter, can you come up and clarify this issue? I think we say $70 million for expediency, basically.
For the record, Alexei Painter, Legislative Finance Division. Sorry, I was identifying the public version of the bill that was copied, just missing some pages. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, if I'm understanding correctly, your question is regarding in the capital budget section, there's $459,000 in unrestricted general funds. Is that a question?
Yes.
What's the question about that?
So I started on page 6 of the bill, where it shows it as unrestricted federal receipts, the $459,000. The previous page shows it as statewide federal programs. It doesn't say receipts there, and so I'm just trying to understand that $459,000.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, so in section 5, it's listed as unrestricted general fund receipts, and that's the same title in section 6. It's just essentially non-matching general funds. So these items in the statewide federal programs appropriation are not match funds. They're just standalone programs. These were both funded last year in the capital budget using ADA reserve funds, which the governor vetoed every appropriation using that ADA reserves. So these two are not related to the match issue. These are just separate appropriations that the governor wishes to make up. So they're just unrestricted general funds, unrelated to match in any way.
Okay. One clarifying, just so I can say it in a way that my brain will stick. So it's not match money, but it is needed supplemental so that we can receive those receipts.
Through the chair, Representative, it has no relation to match. It is another item that the governor has identified as supplemental because the item was vetoed last year. It is not needed to receive receipts. This is unrestricted general funds. This is state general fund dollars. No match. I mean, everything is receipts. Like, receipts is in the formal title of unrestricted general fund receipts. But it's just general funds.
Okay. Thank you.
Co-Chair Shragi.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair to Mr. Alper, I just wanted to go back to your introduction of the Fast Track Supplemental, and you said these are new items, and I think I know what you meant, but I just want to make sure that we're really clear for the public that may be watching. When you say new items, you simply mean that these were costs that were incurred since the passage of the budget that were not included in the budget or that were vetoed out of the budget. Is that correct? I mean, I'm looking at all of these items on here, fire, disaster, those are expenses that weren't in the budget ultimately after vetoes, but those costs were incurred nonetheless. It's not new forward-looking spending. It's new spending since the effective date of the budget or spending that was carried out. Maybe not. Again, new is, I think, a term that maybe is not only confusing me but potentially the public. Can you put a little finer point on that, Mr. Alper?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Shragi. Thank you for saying that. I think that's a very important distinction that you've made. I mean, by the very nature, a supplemental request that shows up halfway through a fiscal year are things that are identified as costs that exist. These have, by and large, happened already, and we simply need to pay for them. We're not trying to find money to do something new. The transportation money, we know the federal money is available, but we need to have this money to be able to acquire it. But yes, these are not new things. And you also said something important. Post-veto, a large portion of these disaster and fire monies were in the budget that the legislature passed last year, but were in fact vetoed, so now need to get put back.
Follow up. Co-Chair Shorty.
Thank you, and through the chair. And then just to really be explicit about all of these items, all of these items were proposed in the governor's budget. These are his requests, things that he would like to see funded in this year's budget, current fiscal year's budget. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Co-Chair Shragi, I would draw your and the other members' attention to the rightmost column in this summary spreadsheet that's labeled source. That points to exactly where in the various other appropriations or other documents that these were referenced. These all came from someplace else. None of them are legislatively originated.
That'll do for now. Thank you.
And Mr. Alper, just to clarify on row number 2, the Medicaid match, on Friday last, the OMB director said twice, that figure identified there will come as an amendment. I think the sense I got was February 2nd or 3rd. Is that your understanding?
Mr. Chairman, the governor is required to send supplementals to the legislature on day 15. Day 15 is right around then. It's early next week. And yes, I heard Ms. Sanders say the same thing. That number will be the number. The report that we have in hand from the Department of Health is that precise number. Mr. Painter has that number in his presentation later on this afternoon. That's going to be talking about pending issues in the budget in a more broad sense. So, yes, we fully expect that will be in the next round of governor supplemental requests.
Okay. Representative Stapp.
Yep. Thank you, Coach Justin, to the chair, and Mr. Alper. Always a pleasure to see you here, Ken. We don't get to see you that often here at the finance table, so it's nice for you to be here. With that nicety out of the way, I'm going to, get down to business through the chair. The intention of this is a finance committee bill. Obviously, that's a unique one. I understand the nature of the governor's structure for a supplemental budget. What is the intendency here for the timeline? Would we refer to this as a fast-track supplemental? Like, what is our intention with this this bill through the chair? If you know, maybe you have to defer to your boss, the co-chair, of course.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, right. The mere fact that we pulled it out and introduced it with the expectation of moving it separately implies fast track. But really, you're asking a policy question that's more properly addressed to the chairman.
Yeah, that's okay. Follow up, Mr. Co-chair?
Yes, follow up.
Through the chair to Mr. Upper, where is the last fast track supplemental appropriation this body passed? Is that still in the Senate Finance Committee through the chair?
I think that it is. That's where it is.
So the reason I asked the question, if I can do a follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair, is oftentimes we refer to things as fast-track, and sometimes it doesn't end up that way. But I am relatively curious regarding this thing about the DOTPF federal match. So with your indulgence, Mr. Co-Chair, if I could get Director Painter back up to the stage here so I can go over
Director
that.
Painter, your question about the DOTPF federal match from Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. To Director Stapp. Painter, I love the new mustache, by the way. I just wanted to put that on the record. But okay, so walk me through. So I'll refer to them as receipts because, I know it makes me happy to use the proper terminology. Walk me through exactly the total amount of UGF or general fund state dollars that are needed to meet the federal match requirements. What is the total amount before we get into the $69 million from last fiscal year through the chair?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. So the total amount the governor had requested was something like between the two federal programs, something like $96 million, I think. So I think they have about $35 million. I'm rounding because I don't have that in front of me, but I think they have about $35 million, and this would bring that up. That math doesn't work out. So
maybe they're 25.
No, I think they have about 30. So I think I was undershooting how much they actually had requested. I think between the two programs, it was over $100 million.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, follow up.
All right.
Staff.
So how much money did the kind of fiscal kabuki tying the aid of receipts to this fund source, how much was that in last appropriation in totality?
Representative Stapp.
Through the chair.
I understand that you want to mock the aid of funding. Do note that the governor, in his first calendar year as a governor, sought to use aid of receipts to fund his dividend program to the tune of, I think, approaching $100 or $200 million. So it's not necessary. I took a class last week on civility. You were there. I just ask that you just ask things as politely as possible.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair. I'll refrain from using the word kabuki. I didn't mean it as an intention. I meant as a reference to just unorthodox, I think is probably a better terminology. Through the chair, Director Painter, getting back on track mentally here because I'm going someplace with this that's actually relatively important. I'm trying to figure out exactly the number here. So how much money did we use from a fund source like the aid of money for this particular line item in totality of, let's say, around the $100 million through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I think I get where you're going with the question. So the ADA receipts were not actually used for match. They were used for other projects. So the amount of the match requested by the governor that was funded with other fund sources, including reappropriations, $41 million of that was reappropriations of old projects, most principally $37 million from the Juno Access Project, and then $3 million from an old earthquake project, then about a million of smaller projects. So there's about that $41 million. And then there was an additional $20 million, $21 million of projects of match that was made up by Old Match, which, you know, as DOT testified, that doesn't really do much. It's mostly just signaling that they have match on hand that they could use. And then there was about $7 million that was not funded at all because the Senate version had come over to this body, funding with additional reapproaches that were pulled out by this committee without replacing that with additional match. So in all, there's about $27 million of matching funds that were essentially not funded by the legislature, kind of intentionally shorted one way or the other. And then the $41 million is the hole that was created by the vetoes of the other projects.
Okay. Fault, Mr.
Follow,
Coacher.
Representative.
Okay. Thank you, Coacher Justin, through the chair to Director Painter. Okay, that's exactly what I was getting at, because obviously the fund source uses and the number being requested, there's a bit of a discrepancy there. So basically, from the beginning, we were a little short on the process, and through the veto process, it got more short, and now that's how we arrived at this situation. Would that be a fair assessment through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, yes. I mean, it was an intentional policy choice by the legislature to not fully fund match with the expectation that the department could use match they had on hand, which, you know, as they've testified, they can make it through FY26 even with a much greater underfunding than what was intended by the legislature, which, you know, illustrates the point that the legislature was making last year. But again, it is a mix of things, you know, a shortfall that was intentional and a shortfall that was not intentional caused by the vetoes.
Thank you.
Mr. Painter, when you say they made the argument that they can run their program without even more funds, you're not taking a position on whether that's what they've said multiple times in this building, but you're not taking a position on the merits of what they said vis-a-vis whether, for example, contracts will be let in an efficient way early in the summer. People won't have to be terminated or lose their job pending those contract lettings. That you're not taking any of that position. You're just reporting what they've said.
Chair Joseph, and that's correct. And specifically, you know, I guess there's a difference between underfunding by $26 million versus underfunding by $70 million in terms of what the impacts on the ground are as well.
All right. I don't see any other questions. So we're going to go to invited testimony on this bill. We're going to start with Alicia Kressel, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name, Ms. Kressel. I see that you're there. Can you, if you are – oh, sorry. Unless you're a saboteur, you're really here. Welcome. Please put your name on the record and give us your testimony about who you are and why you're here.
Thank you. Co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today and for taking up this issue so early in the legislative session. For the record, my name is Alicia Kressel, and I serve as the Executive Director of Associated General Contractors of Alaska. AGC represents more than 600 general contractors, specialty contractors, suppliers, and service providers around the state. I appreciate the chance to offer clarity on the timeline and operational realities surrounding the state transportation match included in HB 283. Over the last couple of weeks, you've heard two messages. Industry has emphasized the urgency of securing the match as soon as possible. DOT has stated that they have sufficient funding to operate through July 2026. I want to be very clear that both of these statements are true. DOT does have the ability to carry its current reduced construction program through July of 2026. That program, submitted to Federal Highways under STIP Amendment 2, reflects a scaled-down set of projects and funding levels based on the limited match currently available. In other words, the department is working with what they have, and under that constrained plan, they can extend funding into July. Now, the difference between securing the match now versus waiting until later in the session is not about whether or not DOT can function. It's about whether DOT, Federal Highways, contractors and communities have the certainty and planning time that is needed to maximize work during the short 2020 construction season and beyond. The project development process, design, environmental approvals, federal authorization, advertisements, bidding, and award follows a strict timeline. When match arrives late, those steps get compressed or deferred entirely. You are introducing unnecessary risk and disruption to this process. When funding comes late, the construction industries and agencies can shift from planning mode into scramble mode. To their credit, DOT worked extremely hard last year to push out projects after early delays in program delivery. They did exactly what they said they were going to do. And they also secured a historic level of August redistribution, which Alaska will benefit greatly from. We all want to preserve that momentum. Uncertainty around traditional match funding disrupts project sequencing, contractor workforce planning, the availability of equipment and materials, and the ability to secure the maximum amount of August redistribution. Late funding can also remove flexibility from the current program, which DOT did mention in Senate Finance this morning. For example, if a project finishes up early, DOT may or may not be able to pull another project off the shelf and put it out to bid, which does often happen later in the construction season if the perfect circumstances allow. And alternatively, if a project cost does rise unexpectedly, DOT may halt or delay another planned project because it may not have the ability to rely on an unsecured match later in the year. Under a constrained budget, there is very little ability to adjust, absorb changes, or accelerate work. And that ultimately harms industry and the economy. DOT has accurately described its ability to stretch the reduced program through July. What industry is describing is the opportunity cost, the work that cannot be delivered without timely match certainty, the projects that cannot be advanced, and the planning time that cannot be recovered. We all know that you have an incredibly difficult job to do, but there are very few financial decisions that legislators will make that have this kind of guaranteed return on investment that the 90-10 match has. And early clarity on this match funding strengthens the entire system. It gives DOT the certainty to plan and obligate funds efficiently. It gives federal highways confidence in our state's ability to deliver. It gives contractors the lead time needed to hire, schedule, and mobilize. And it gives communities reliability and about the projects that they depend on. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify and provide this context and comments today.
Ms. Crystal, quick comment for me, and that is I'm relieved, particularly in this day and age, that we have truth tellers on both sides. And I appreciate you saying that. That's helpful. My question for you before we entertain other questions is how long can you lay a little foundation? What is your business? How long have you done this? And have you ever seen a match come so late?
Chair Josephson, so I've been Executive Director of Associated General Contractors since 2018. And I have never seen match funding come this late. In fact, I believe the last time Alaska missed its standard funding may have been around 1985, so it's been a number of years. This is unprecedented.
Unprecedented. Thank you. Representative Allard.
Thank you. And this is not a gotcha moment. I want to know your opinion on it through the chair. Could you tell me what you think the reason is for that?
The reason is for what?
For the delay. I'm sorry. I was following up on Chair Josephson's question.
All right.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, it's as a result of a breakdown in the budgeting process last year.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Alicia Kressel? Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. Thank you for being here. Obviously, I understand how important it is that we be doing these types of work in Alaska, building capital, putting people to work, puts food on families' tables, and keeps us very busy. It also creates a stable environment for bringing people into the industry. So I absolutely support you guys 100% and understand the industry need. Can you talk a little bit about the interactions you're currently having with Department of Transportation to get some level of certainty from them that we aren't going to have those disruptions. I do understand that getting the money in your hands or in our hands as soon as possible to ensure that we're getting those federal matches is very important, obviously very concerning for you guys. But can you talk a little bit about those conversations that you're currently having, if you can, and what level of confidence you have that this session or going into the summer, that we're not going to have those uncertainties?
Ms. Crystal.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, thank you for that question. For the past year, DOT, to their credit, has offered public monthly tentative advertising schedule updates to the contracting community and the general public. Now, right now, we're pretty early on in the bidding process in terms of, you know, what the outlook looks like for the 2026 construction season. I can tell you that based on the last TAS update, is what they're called, there is a list of projects that is ready to go, and we hope to see those bid very soon. So I think the next few weeks will be very telling on how that project delivery timeline is looking.
Follow-up, Representative Bynum for Ms. Crystal.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. You know, my professional background, I come from the hydropower business line, and, you know, when we talk about planning for projects, years can be in the process. What kind of forecast do you need for your industries to be feel comfortable that we're going to be getting the work out there that you need and proper planning? Are you looking at, is 6 months going to be sufficient for you, or do you need a much longer lead time?
Ms. Crystal.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, that's really, it depends. It really depends on the type of project, where the project is located, how complex it is, what the workforce needs are. And so, you know, a contractor could turn and burn on a project fairly quickly if they happen to already have equipment and personnel mobilized out into an area, or if it's on, you know, they're on the road system and they have the availability. But certainly for larger, more complex projects that we tend to have in Alaska here, just based on our geographical complexity, we certainly prefer, you know, 6 months to a year of lead time, if not more.
Follow up. Representative Bynum.
Thank you. Tell us a little bit about, if you can, what you think happens to the quality of projects and or the cost of projects when we don't have that lead time.
Ms. Crystal.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I cannot speak to the quality of those projects because we will always put out a really good product, but it becomes more challenging for the construction community. You know, we want to do good work for the Department of Transportation. We want to do good work for the state of Alaska. And when, you know, project timelines become constrained and the typical process isn't followed, we don't have that lead time, that can, you know, challenge the contractors and the DOT to try to find solutions that could have otherwise been solved through, you know, a longer lead time and better planning.
Thank you.
Okay. Co-Chair Shragi.
Hi, Ms. Crystal. Thank you for being here today. Really appreciate it. I have here before me a Meet the Match letter that was sent to, I believe, everyone's inboxes. And content of the letter aside for a moment, I'm most struck by the breadth of the coalition that is behind this letter. And it seems, I mean, some of these logos I've never seen together seems quite remarkable. Is it as remarkable as I think it is? Is it unprecedented? Have you seen a letter with this kind of consensus on what is needed and the need to advocate on this issue?
Through the chair, Representative Shragi, thank you for acknowledging that. That letter is remarkable, and it was not a heavy lift. Every organization that we reached out to and explained this problem to, ones that we even thought were kind of a long shot, jumped on board immediately. And for us, that was really a signal that, wow, this is a bigger issue than just the construction industry. We provide access to every industry, to all sorts of communities and projects across the state of Alaska. This impacts everyone, not just us.
Follow-up. Representative Sherman.
Yes. Can I interrupt for just a second?
Briefly,
yes, what's your thank you. the letter that he has that he's reading from in committee, I'd like him to put a copy out to everybody since he's introduced it on the record.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very well. So through the chair, I believe this was emailed to every legislator, but we'll make sure to get a copy posted to BASIS for anyone that may be looking. For those that don't have the letter in hand, I was actually just going to remark, I mean, the Alaska Chamber, the Alaska Miners Association, AGC, your own institution, Alaska Trucking Association. I see quite a few unions, AFL-CIO is among others. Juneau Chamber of Commerce, Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, Alaska Bankers Association, AOGA. This is a heavy-hitting letter, in my opinion. And again, I've never seen something quite like it. And I guess when I receive letters like this, I wonder what the impetus was. You don't see these very often. And we had DOT here before us yesterday, and I think my takeaway was that there wasn't a lot of urgency or concern. And so I'm trying to square that with this letter. I presume from your remarks that the concern isn't that we don't have faith in DOT. It seems to me that must not be it based on the remarks that have been given so far. So is it? What else is it? I mean, the thing that makes the most sense to me is what's been kind of alluded to a little bit is just the risk and uncertainty that all the organizations here, your members, are facing with regards to this construction season. And we talk all the time about the importance of certainty and reducing risk in our resource development sector, just in terms of economic development, business development. For us to be successful, we need to provide a low-risk business climate. Is that where this is coming from, that uncertainty is that concerning to you all, that is a major hurdle that requires not only your attention and advocacy, but for us to do something? Can you just help me understand why I have a letter like this in my hands when DOT seems to think that we can wait until July?
Ms. Kressel.
Through the chair, Representative Shragi, yes, it is all about the certainty that it provides to the industry and to the industries that are on that letter and to the agencies that support those projects.
And follow up, what are some of the impacts of that uncertainty? Like, just give me some real tangible consequences. Are businesses deciding not to purchase supplies that they would otherwise be purchasing right now to ensure that they have in hand when those projects come? What are some of those examples of maybe problems that would occur from that uncertainty?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Shragi, that's a really great question. So Thursday, AGC releases its economic impact on the construction industry in Alaska, and the construction dollar in Alaska's economy really has an outsized trickle-down impact, both directly and indirectly, on our economy. And so when you see the loss of a construction dollar in the state, it means not only the loss of someone's paycheck, but it's the loss of supplies that you would have bought with a local vendor. It's the loss of, groceries that are bought at a local grocery store and what those employees do with that paycheck, as well as, how some of those materials are bought in Alaska. So it is really an outsized impact on Alaska's economy. We're not just talking about $700 million. We're talking a lot more than that when you're talking about Alaska's economic impact.
Thank you. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair. Thank you for your testimony. Actually, most of what I want to say, Co-Chair Shragi asked fairly eloquently. I would just say, going forward in the future, you made a really good case, I think, about stability and reliability and how important Alaska's contractor sector is to really the lifeblood of our state in terms of industry. If you had a message for the legislature in terms of, like, how we should want to prioritize your funding, I mean, you made a comment earlier which I thought was really impactful, where it was a budgetary snafu or something like that that kind of put us in this. So what message would you want to tell us at the Finance Committee going forward of how we look at the importance of federal highway match and how we should appropriate money through that, through the chair?
Ms. Kressel.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, the message that I would send is, one, this is a situation that we haven't been in a long time, and there's a reason for that. And we would ask that we not be in this situation again. moving forward and, you know, again, providing stability to the contracting community, to DOT, to the people who rely on construction-related jobs is incredibly important. So thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. I'd be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity to reflect back on how we have been funding capital in recent years. Obviously, it feels like we're funding the minimum to get just the match. Could you tell us what you think Alaska would look like if we were serious about actually investing in capital in this state, specifically going beyond just the minimums of match, but really investing in Alaska and investing in families, investing in jobs, and building the state? What is your vision for what Alaska would look like if we actually were serious about investing in capital?
Ms. Crystal.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, it's probably the same vision that all of you here have and why you serve here in the legislature, and that is to have a prosperous Alaska, to have, you know, development projects, healthy jobs, strong communities, strong transportation, plans that connect those communities, and to be able to have a workforce that can move between, you know, various projects throughout the state, whether that's a construction surface transportation job or a job in oil and gas or the mining industry. There's all, I mean, the transferable skills that a job in the construction industry has really has a lot of potential for other industries as well. So we will build the infrastructure that also, you know, help to build some of those projects that Alaska would love to see move forward eventually.
I'll follow up, Representative Bynum, for Ms. Crasson.
From what you're seeing in industry, if we actually did make that kind of investment, what would you think that would mean for bringing families and working jobs into the state? Obviously, one of the concerns we see in our community, we talk about all the time, education always gets brought up. One of the problems we have with education is we have declining enrollment in our schools. So if we did have this robust capital plan in play, or capital, not only capital plan, but capital funding, do you envision seeing more families, working age families with kids coming into our communities and making our communities thrive?
Ms. Kressel.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, absolutely. You know, the average wage of a construction worker in Alaska is over $100,000 a year, and that is a living that you can support a family on. And that's a number that we're very proud of. We have an 82% Alaska local hire rate. We want to see that number even more. And so, you know, the economic opportunity that comes with a construction job is incredible.
Thank you very much.
All right. We're going to – thank you, Ms. Kressel. We're going to move on to our second invited testifier. This time I'll check to see if she's here. I don't think she is. Again, thank you, Ms. Kressel. We'll go to Rebecca Logan, CEO of the Alliance. It says she's in Anchorage, so – expect her to...
I'm here.
Good afternoon, Ms.
Good afternoon, Logan. Chairman Josephson and members of the committee. Can you hear me?
We can. Just identify yourself and provide your testimony.
I will. For the record, my name is Rebecca Logan, and I'm the CEO of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, which is a professional trade organization that represents Alaska companies who provide support to oil, gas, and mining operations around our state. Our current membership is well over 500 companies, and those member companies employ about 35,000 people. And many of my members are also members of AGC. So it should be no surprise that I'm here today to support House Bill 283. Federal transportation programs provide Alaska with such a significant and reliable source of infrastructure funding each year, with the only requirement to access them being a state match. And when we fulfill that obligation, we unlock roughly nine times that amount in federal investment. And, you know, if you think about it, there are very few state expenditures that deliver that level of return. And this is not a new approach, as you all already know. Alaska has relied on this partnership with the federal government for decades to build and maintain our roads and bridges and ports and airports. And it's a proven model that works when we provide stability and we act on time. And again, that's why the Alliance supports the request in the governor's supplemental budget. It's a strategic investment that will allow approximately $700 million in more funding to flow into Alaska. And that funding supports construction jobs and engineering and design work, material suppliers, local contractors, and small businesses across the state. just as important as the dollars themselves is, as you heard Alicia testify, the timing. Our construction season is short, and it's expensive, and it's unforgiving. Our agencies and our contractors and our communities need predictability well in advance to plan projects, very importantly, to secure labor and the equipment and to sequence work efficiently. Failing to meet that federal match or waiting until the last possible moment puts hundreds of millions of federal dollars at risk, and it disrupts project schedules and workforce planning, and it could lead to long-term increases in costs due to inflation and remobilization. Approving the match now sends a clear signal that Alaska is serious about fiscal responsibility and infrastructure investment and the efficient use of our limited construction window. So in closing, meeting the federal transportation match is smart, time-sensitive investing, and acting quickly provides the certainty needed to plan projects, line up materials, and fully utilize Alaska's short construction season. If you read the Fairbanks Daily News Miner today, you would have seen a column from Meg Nordale of Gemmed Construction on this topic, where she ended by saying, predictable investment allows employers to plan and hire. It supports apprenticeship programs and career pathways and gives young Alaskans a reason to train here, work here, and stay here. So that predictability certainly matters. And, you know, you asked Alicia to give you an example of what could happen if funds weren't appropriated in a timely manner. And it just reminded me of a situation last summer where I was in Fairbanks and listening to three young people talk about how they had come to Fairbanks. They were in one of the union halls, and they had planned on having a very busy, productive, earning summer working on road construction. And due to some of the things that happened last year, none of those projects ever came to fruition. And those young people were now working, they were all working at one job and looking to find another job. And we all know what we need to do to make sure that we maintain our young people here, that we keep them here. And so having these predictable industries that provide predictable and stable jobs is just so important to us. And with that, I'll end my testimony and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Logan. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Ms. Logan? Co-Chair Schrage.
Thank you, Chair Josephson, through the chair. Thank you so much for being here, Ms. Logan. Really appreciate you weighing in and for joining this coalition on this issue. You know, we keep hearing about the importance of certainty and being able to plan and to the long lead times for your industries. And again, I'm thinking back to the testimony we received yesterday. Is it your perspective as the CEO of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance that if we were to delay until, say, May to provide this funding, would that have an impact, a material impact, on the construction industry this summer and this next year?
Ms. Logan.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think Alicia agreed with that also. You know, when you have a very short amount of time to plan, one of the things that happens in Alaska, and I've seen this in 16 years in the oil and gas industry, when projects and work go away, so does the support industry. And so you lose people and you lose equipment. So if you don't have the lead time to plan for that, it's really, really challenging to make up those differences of workforce and having the appropriate equipment in a short amount of time.
One follow-up, if I may.
Yes, follow-up. Co-Chair Schrage for Ms. Logan.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, and through the chair. You know, we face a difficult budget climate this session. I think it's going to be difficult for us to make progress in a lot of areas, let alone to support our industries. When I think of the opportunities that are before us, one of the ways that I view we could most impactfully support our resource development and construction industries would be to meet this match and provide early certainty to our construction and resource development industries. Would you agree that this is probably in the top three in terms of things that we could do to support industry and resource development this year?
Ms. Logan.
I would, and that's why you see, you know, we typically we have that as one of our legislative priorities this year, the Alliance, and that's probably the first time we've weighed in something like that. But clearly, with shared membership with AGC and with so much of the work that we do dependent on a strong construction industry and the transportation systems and the supply chains, it's critical for everybody. And that's why you saw such a diverse group of people signing on to that letter. At the 50,000 level, foot level, it's a policy about stability. And at the 5,000 foot level, it's about the things that we have to happen here, literally on the ground, to support our industries.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Logan.
A question from representative staff for Ms. Logan.
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph, through the chair to Ms. Logan. Ms. Logan, always great to hear from you. We're big fans of the Alliance and all that you wonderful folks there do. I think you hit the nail on the head again with your response to Representative Co-Chair Shiragi about stability. I'm curious if the Alliance had any concerns last fiscal year when you saw the legislature tie the match funding to a fund source that was not general funds through the chair.
Ms. Logan.
So we had a concern about what was going to happen. And last year we had the luxury of I shouldn't even use the word luxury because that's disrespectful to the people who didn't have work that they were planning on. There was a lot of work on the North Slope last year, so a lot of my members who didn't have the work in the construction industry that they would normally plan on, they had work on the North Slope. So we had a concern that things might not go well.
Fault, Ms. Co-Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin. Through the chair to Ms. Logan. Would you fair to kind of elaborate on that concern? Did you feel like the legislature was prioritizing your stability last year when that event happened or not, through the chair?
Ms. Logan.
I honestly have to say I don't remember if I had that feeling, that thought at all at that point. It was just more about wondering how things were going to end up and less about worrying how we got there.
Thank you.
All right. I think we're going to now move on to our last testifier. We have a second important part of the hearing, and I have a hard stop at 3:25. So we're going to go to – first, we're going to thank Ms. Logan. Appreciate your testimony. We're going to go to Scott Vieira, also in Anchorage. Mr. Vieira.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Scott Vieira. I'm the Director of Business Development for North Star Terminal and Steve Gore, North Star. I'd like to say hello to the chair, vice chair, members of the committee, and everyone joining us today.
Scott, let me interrupt you. Yes. Can you do your darndest to speak right into whatever microphone or device
I'm
you're using?
I'm sorry. I'll take it off speaker. Is that better?
Thank you. It's much better.
You bet. Okay. As I was saying, I'm calling from Anchorage, but we operate 8 facilities throughout Alaska. Dead Horse, North Pole, Delta Junction, Anchorage, Seward, Homer, Valdez, and Dutch Harbor. And we support the oil and gas mining and construction infrastructure projects throughout Alaska. We also employ a few thousand longshoremen to support project cargo and the tourism industry. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify in strong support of HB 283 with swift passage of this bill, specifically the approximately $70 million needed for DOT and PF to meet the required state match for federal transportation funding. This state match is not optional. I mean, it will unlock roughly $700 million in total construction investment this summer if the legislative group does not act quickly and fast-track and pass this bill. These federal funds may be delayed or even lost. So say we move forward, the legislator approves this, then the project has to go to DOT, be reapproved for the engineering, then go out to bid. There's another 3 to 5 week delay, then the award, then the contracts, and then they got to get, everybody's got to source the materials for the project. And many of these materials need to be procured out of state and transported to Alaska. So in Alaska, we all know time is the enemy, and our construction season is short. I mean, this funding is fundamentally about jobs and workforce stability. And after last year's initial project delivery challenges, let's say, getting those projects out quick was, to say the least, a challenge. But it created loss and delays of significant projects, and many contractors had to reduce their workforce by 20% to 50%, and some are still on the verge of closing their doors. And without certainty, continuity, these skilled operators and mechanics and blue-collar workforces are forced to leave Alaska for steady work in the lower 48. I mean, that would be a hard hit. These same workers support the oil, gas, and mining projects. And once their families leave Alaska, they're extremely difficult to replace. And that would be weakening multiple sectors of Alaska's economy. And many of your constituents will leave. And we don't want that. And $700 million through the DOT construction season would support approximately 25 to 30 major projects statewide. That's just not roads and bridges, airports. This should bring dock and marine system projects affecting almost everyone's district. Those projects would probably generate about 4,000 to 6,000 direct jobs and a significant secondary economic activity in transportation, materials, lodging, housing, local businesses across Alaska. I mean, this is the smartest investment Alaska can make. And as you know, we've met the match for decades. Failing to provide the full match would delay projects, increase cost. Most importantly, we will lose jobs and weaken Alaska's workforce. And that would hurt us significantly if the LNG pipeline comes to fruition. One of the reasons I'm testifying today is our civil side took a big hit last year. We had to reduce 30% of our workforce. And I respectfully urge the committee to support HB 283, ensure DOT and PF receives the full, uncompromised state match as quickly as possible. Alaska, we can't afford to lose construction jobs two summers in a row. More importantly, we can't afford to lose our workforce to the lower 48, because once those workers leave, getting them back is far more difficult and far more costly. I appreciate your time and consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vieira. I hope you'll entertain some questions. We'll start with Representative Bynum.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, and thank you for testifying today. I was hoping you could, again, remind us again of the trades that you're representing and how many work and jobs does that actually bring in here into Alaska. That's the first part of the question. The second part of the question is a follow-up, or basically a replica of the question I'd asked previously, talking about if we actually had a real robust capital program in the state of Alaska, how do you think that would actually impact your ability to be providing those working jobs that are paying families and keeping families here in Alaska?
A couple questions.
Roger
there,
that.
Mr. Vieira. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. So how many jobs? Well, so we have an off-dock division and an on-dock division. So our on-dock division, our waterside, Anchorage, Stewart, Homer, Valdez, and Dutch Harbor, they do project cargo. They're longshoremen. So there's a significant amount. I think we had a total of like 5,000 W-2s last year. 90% of those are longshoremen. So all the project cargo and in addition to the tourism business, that's also included. Our off-dock division, we've got, 40 cranes, a bunch of drill rigs, big hammers. We do large infrastructure projects, whether it's military, refineries, DOT, anything of that nature. So we'll have, probably 60, 70 core guys that we keep on. And then when we basically bring a bunch of people in, say we've got these projects sitting in front of us, we'll bring in another 40 to 60 guys to, produce them on the slope for the oil and gas, or we would rather, in our summer, in the summer season, we would have them on civil projects if we had the big projects out there, not the scrape and paves and payment type scenarios that kind of were made out last minute. And thank God they came out because it did save some jobs. But the reality of it is the significant projects, those bring long-term jobs. And if this pipeline hits, we want to keep the people here. Please remind me what the second part of that question was. I'm sorry.
Just talking about, through the chair, the second part of the question is really talking about having a robust financial investment from Alaska in our capital program and what that would actually mean for long-term stability for the people you represent.
Mr. Vieira. And then we're going to wrap up.
I would say, obviously it's going to bring more people. We need to bring up people from the lower 48. One of the main topics at AGC, I sit on the board for AGC, we had all the possible governor candidates come around, and our biggest problem, I think everybody at the table was, how are we going to bring more people from education or you know, I should say high school or college into the trades? What is their plan to do that? Well, the more projects that we have, the more it entices people to go out and earn these $100,000-plus-a-year jobs. So the more money we have, the more jobs it's going to produce, and the secondary funds just keep rolling out to the communities and what have you. But, you know, that allows us to buy more equipment, create more have more people, and create more jobs and families and fill the schools up. So it's just a snowball effect, and we need your help.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Vieira. We are going to hold this bill. I want to clarify the record just a little bit. It'll help the members. Our first testifier, Alicia Kressel, if it wasn't known, is Executive Director of the Associated General Contractors. Our second, I think, made clear, Rebecca Logan, that she's Executive Officer with Alaska Support Industry Alliance. And our last testifier, Mr. Vieira, is in Business Development for North Star Equipment Services. We're going to take about a 30-second at ease and set up for Mr. Painter. I thank all the testifiers. We will hold House Bill 283 for the time being. We're at ease. All right, we're back on record. Second on our agenda today is an overview by the Legislative Finance Division. With us from the division is our own Alexei Painter, Legislative Fiscal Analyst. Mr. Painter, please come forward, put yourself on record to begin your presentation. We will get as far through this as we are able to. Please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alexei Painter, Legislative Finance Division. And I can either try to go quickly or just see how we go and see where we are. To the will of the committee, I suppose.
Let's see what we can get done.
All right. Okay. So I'll skip the outline and just go right into it. So some of the recap, I think you guys heard from OMB, but when the legislature adjourned last year, we had a projected budget deficit in FY25 and a surplus in FY26 based on the spring forecast. The vote to fill that FY25 deficit from the Constitutional Budget Reserve failed. So that meant that the budget deficit would first come from a draw from the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, and then the remainder from the Higher Education Investment Fund. And there was no source for any potential FY26 deficit, which is obviously addressed in the bill that was heard earlier in this hearing. Building the FY26 budget, the legislature accepted about $43 million of the governor's $80 million UGF increments, so about half of them. They added $44.5 million of increases that were not proposed by the governor and then made $34 million of budget reductions. So all in all, we ended up with a budget that was other than, and this doesn't include the K-12 impact of the legislation that was passed, but essentially we ended up with a budget that was a little bit smaller than the governor's request because the denied increments were and the cuts were less than the things that were added. The legislature's budget fully funded the K-12 formula and most of the statewide items with the exception of school debt reimbursement and community assistance fund. The legislature's budget also funded the fire suppression fund and disaster relief fund at their five-year average.
Okay, slide four.
So you heard an extensive conversation on vetoes yesterday, so I won't dwell on those, but to recap, there were some vetoes in FY25, and then including the reappropriations for DOT match, and the ADA portion of the deficit fill language, leaving the rest to come out of the higher education fund. In FY26, the vetoes included $103 million from the operating budget, $14.3 million from the capital budget. The largest of those vetoes was for the K-12 foundation formula, and the legislature overrode that veto. And other vetoes included funding from the fire suppression fund, disaster relief fund, and major maintenance grant fund. And then after that override, the enacted FY26 budget had a projected surplus of $130 million based on the spring forecast.
And does that include veto dollars that came back?
Yes.
Okay. So that's all in, $130.
Right. And that includes the override as well.
All right. Hannon, then Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Mr. Painter, I want to just affirm because during some questions a little bit ago, there was reference that sort of implied that the DOT match in the budget last year wasn't UGF. And I want to affirm that the reappropriation money, that 62.2, is general fund money, even though it's in a reappropriation.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, it is the original fund source of those appropriations had been UGF, and then they were appropriated to a project. But they are UGF. They can be used for anything. They're just appropriated to existing projects.
Thank you.
Great. Slide. Oh, sorry. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair, Director Painter, I'm seeing two different numbers for the veto for the K-12 foundation formula. So what we received vis-a-vis this spreadsheet, this line 25 has the veto number at 50.64 million, and this is at 45.4. Is that because of the more clarification that came out later?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, the Legislative Finance Division and Office of Management and Budget disagree about the effect of that veto. I wrote a memo to the legislature that was posted on our website and emailed around with our June newsletter about that.
I'm sorry I missed that. If I may follow up, would you please clarify what was said in the newsletter, because I did not read that.
So the short version through the chair is it's kind of academic now because the veto was overridden, but the legislature had reduced the funding into the estimate for the into the public education fund due to funds that were anticipated by the administration to be spent on pre-K that could not statutorily be spent, because there's a provision that says that the pre-K funding can only go up by $3 million per year. Yeah. And so the legislature essentially reduced that amount so that it down to the statutory level. The Office of Management and Budget had not reflected that change, and so they were using an estimate that did not incorporate that change, essentially. So our view was that if the veto had stood, the impact would only be $45 million versus their projection was $50 million. But essentially, that's just a disagreement about how to count that pre-K money. But it's now academic
right.
because of the override.
Now it's all restored. Yeah, thank you very much.
Let's go to slide five.
So, and then after we adjourned the special session, I would note that during session, and when the governor signed the budget, there was significant skepticism about the $68 price in the spring forecast. Prices had gone down after the spring forecast. The governor had issued an unofficial revenue forecast when he signed the bill that used $62 a barrel, which turns out to be fairly close to the fall forecast. And the legislature had been aiming, the Senate aimed for $64 a barrel. I think conference committee ended up at something like $66 a barrel or something. But essentially everybody was aiming under the fall forecast, the spring forecast, because of skepticism about that $68 price. And in fact, the fall forecast does reduce the projected FY26 price to $65.48, and it reduces projected revenue by $181 million. So that's actually more than you'd think, just that $2.5 price, because of reduced production, increased expenses, and also reduced corporate income tax. So that changes us from having a $130 million surplus now to a projected $51 million deficit before any supplemental appropriations.
Tough times. Slide six.
More about sort of FY25. I was asked to talk a bit more history on the current year. So one of the things we've touched on is vacancy rates. This is using OMB's data. We actually calculate a little differently than OMB using the same data. But I want to highlight the trend that last session, I think I highlighted in a presentation, maybe it wasn't in this committee, that the trend on hiring was getting better. The vacancy rate had dropped by over 2% over the course of between the beginning of fiscal year 25 and where we were around when we adjourned. The governor announced a hiring freeze in May in response to the lower oil prices, and we can see that between that and potentially other factors, since it may have started a little earlier, the vacancy rates rose again. So the vacancy rates did begin to rise. They seem to be potentially going back down in December. But we have seen that trend we had seen where vacancies were getting better had started to go the other direction, which coincides with the hiring freeze.
Slide seven.
Oh, sorry, there's a question.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph. Through the chair, do you have a dollar figure? Associated, a rough guess on what that number represents of vacancies for the state?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, not really. And I'll kind of talk in the next slide about the how much lapse there was and where it went. So I'll get to that sort of, yeah.
Thank you.
So in FY25, given the vacancies, it should be no surprise that there was some lapse. There's a waterfall in the budget each year for what happens with various lapsing dollars. Some of these items in FY25 were the usual items. The legislature also inserted an additional item. So every item but the school major maintenance grant fund is kind of a usual item for this lapse waterfall. The school major maintenance grant fund was an attempt by the legislature, knowing that there was vacant positions, we can use some of that lapse and carry it forward to put into the major maintenance grant fund. However, that didn't quite work because a combination of less lapse than I think was perhaps anticipated due to either the positive trend in vacancy rates through most of the year where, you know, we were looking at prior the first half of the year and vacancy rates were higher than they ended up for the full year. But also a lot of that vacancy funding ends up going to contracts to do the same work or overtime for other workers. Less of it ends up lapsing than you'd think. A fair amount did lapse, but it went mostly into the group health and life benefits fund. $23.1 million went into that fund. What that fund does is it's used for the Alaska Care, which is the state's health care program, health insurance for state employees and retirees, specifically to the Alaska Care has been relying on these lapsing funds in lieu of increasing the rates to the full actuarial need. There was intent language in the FY26 budget directing the Department of Administration to begin increasing the rate to avoid this problem, but in FY25, that was before that had happened, and so they used $23 million. That still leaves $1.6 million that they were not able to fill with available lapse that will be carried forward and use lapse in FY26. I would note that in response to that intent language, they still did not increase the rates to the full actuarial need. They increased them by 6.4%, the same amount in FY25. They did increase employee premiums, but they did not increase employer costs. And as a result, they're still heavily relying on lapse. The estimate is that in FY26, they'll need, or FY26, I don't remember the number off the top of my head. It's still over $10 million. FY27, it's, I think, $18 to $26 million. And they project that without policy changes, they could be using $27 to $50 million of lapse a year. So the current structure where Alaska Care is sort of eating up all of our laps means that, you know, when we have these vacancies, essentially it just goes to subsidize Alaska Care because the rate that the Department of Administration is charging is not sufficient. So I apologize for the digression, but I do think it's important to know where tens of millions of dollars are going that we expected could go to school major maintenance grant funds. I'm noted on the last slide, the governor vetoed $25 million for that fund. The legislature had set up so that those funds could first come from lapse, and then if there was insufficient lapse, they'd come from the general fund in FY26. The governor vetoed that number down so that $4.9 million came from this lapse, and then the remaining amount, I think it was about $8 million, came from the FY26 budget, but no additional funds. And again, given that the lapse was going into the group health and life benefits fund, there wouldn't have been enough lapse to make that full amount anyway, so it would have essentially added to what we now have as the FY26 deficit. There was none needed for some of these other accounts, and then $5 million for central services, the rate smoothing appropriation. And so if you're wondering where the lapse went, none of it went to the constitutional budget reserve. So that deficit that was projected in FY25, it was about $188 million. The actual transfer was $129 million from the higher ed fund. That reduction is entirely because of revenue coming in slightly above forecast. None of it is because of lapsing appropriations, because every dollar of general fund lapse was used for the waterfall.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Chair Justin, through the chair to Director Painter. Okay, so a couple of questions here through the chair. First would be, when's the last time that employer contributions for Alaska Care was raised? Do you know, or do I got to go after DOA for that?
Through the chair, Representative, they've been raised every year, but not to the full actuarial amount.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair, Director Painter. Is there ever a kind of a given rhyme or reason that we are not using the full actuarial amount for the contribution rate? Other than that, we just like the fact that we can capitalize it through LAPS, through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, the response to the intent language was that the department intends to take what they called a conservative stair-stepped approach, where they would increase by 6.4% and increase the employee cost. I think relying this heavily on lapse is a problem, and that they should increase the rates more to avoid that problem. $27 to $50 million is more than we can expect, but I think they're wary of just adding to the budget, essentially, because it would add significantly to the budget if you shifted that.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Kutcher.
Follow up, Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Kutcher, Justin, through the chair, Director Painter. Yeah, I mean, obviously that's the only rhyme or reason I could make sense of employee contributions going up and not employer contributions, right, because you'd have to put that in the budget. But second kind of thought on this, Director Painter, would be I feel like we struggle with OMB on a disconnect in their lapse reports, right? Because every year that I've looked at their lapse reports, they almost always project zero lapses, even up till the end of the legislature. And then obviously we know we have vacancies above the factor, so we know we're going to lapse money. And I feel like I have to run to you every year and help me calculate with your human computer brain. Is there any way that we can get some sort of get on the same page here with OMB so we have some idea? Because I know they're going to lapse money. They do it every year. Their positions are unfilled, but they never admit they're going to lapse anything through the chair.
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. So, you know, when we do lapse calculations, we're looking at the vacant positions, and, you know, you can sort of make a lapse calculation from that. I think, you know, what the experience shows in FY25 is that not everything that you would expect to lapse may end up actually lapsing versus getting reused for another purpose by agencies. So, you know, one example is, and I'll get to this kind of in another slide, but, you know, both the Department of Health and Department of Family and Community Services have language allowing them to transfer money between appropriations. So when they lapse in one place, they use it to fill a hole somewhere else. So in Family and Community Services, they actually still didn't have enough money, even with using all their lapse and moving it over, to fulfill what they owed for the Pioneer Home payment assistance. So when we underfund items like that in the budget, they use their lapse, transfer it across appropriations, and so then what we can project will lapse doesn't, because it gets used for another purpose. And that would be an example of that. And that's the challenge. We can try to improve our lapse projections, but, you know, as I think Director Sanders correctly pointed out when we talked about this, that it's not necessarily going to actually materialize as lapse just because it's available because the original purpose was not fulfilled.
Now, final follow-up.
Final follow-up. Yep.
Thank you, Coach Wilson, to the chair, to Director Painter. Regarding the $10 million in authorization, lapsing authority, Department of Health, DFCS, it's how do we communicate that? I mean, that's a lot for DFCS, a lot of cross-appropriation authority, and the fact that they had to use all of it is really concerning to me, because that means that we kind of grossly underestimated what we were going to spend on the Pioneer Home. So, what in your opinion, what is the best way to try to solve that problem so we have a more clear understanding of what our projected expenditures would be through the chair?
Mr. Payne.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, you know, that's a difficult one because it's hard to project the need for the Pioneer Homes because it depends on their residents and their population changes. So if they're... It's sort of a difficult policy choice for the legislature and governor. If you put extra money in there to build in a margin of error, that money might end up lapsing. If you put not enough, you know, without building in a margin of error, then, you know, they can have to transfer. So what's in the governor's budget now, I think they've said that in FY26 they probably are projecting to be short based on their current population. Getting to project what the population might look like in a year is difficult. But I would say that the way to avoid that is to give additional money in the budget. It's just obviously that comes from somewhere else if we have a limited resources in the budget.
Thank Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. And, you know, I know we got a lot of material to go through here. But since we're talking about it, I figured I might as well bring it up. You know, for me, when we look at these practices where we have all these open positions, we know we have open positions. We know that next year we'll probably have open positions, and we fund these open positions. I don't have a problem with funding open positions. But what I find problematic, and I think what Alaskans find problematic, is that we do have this waterfalling where we have all this revenue or all this money left over from these open positions, and then we just fill shortfalls as we go. And then we get to this process for the new budget coming up, and we do the same thing over. Can you tell us a little bit about how long this practice has actually been happening in the budgeting process?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, it's been a very long time that we've had some sort of lapsing waterfall. It's relatively new within the last 5 years or so that there's been planned use of lapse versus... You know, the way the Group Health and Life Benefits Fund is set up is that generally AlaskaCare sets their rates. Sometimes there's unusually expensive health claims, or you know, a new drug on the market that's very expensive, and so pharmaceutical costs go up, so they have to pull laps unexpectedly. That's kind of the intended use of the fund, where it's used occasionally because of something coming up. This planned use is a new practice within, I think, since the COVID pandemic has been where they've had this planned usage, and that's not been a historical norm.
A quick follow-up.
Thank you. So if we just said, we all agreed here that we know there's cost, but we don't like this process, let's stop doing that process, what would the consequence be?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. So if we don't put money into the group health life benefits fund, because the legislature can't set the AlaskaCare rate, that the Department of Administration does, essentially that fund would be short and would have to increase rates even more next year. That sort of happened with the University of Alaska, where they also self-insure, and last year there was kind of an extra $10 million or so in their health care, the rates that we had to pay to make up for a previous shortfall. So it would be end up being something like that if we just shorted them from lapse.
Couldn't we, through the chair?
Yes.
Couldn't we just resolve that problem through the supplemental process?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I'm not quite sure what you mean by a supplemental directly into the fund rather than using lapse, or I'm not...
Correct. Mr. Bynum. Correct. Representative Bynum.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Bynum, yes, we could, instead of using lapse, just put money directly into the fund.
Okay. Thank you.
The downside of that versus a rate is that the rate would charge all fund sources when we just deposit money in the fund to be all general funds.
Great. Thank you.
Let's go to slide 8.
So more about history. There's been some overspending of appropriations as well. So in FY24, legislative audit identified the Department of Corrections overspend its UGF appropriations by $8 million. The Office of Management and Budget changed some of the practices and how they report actual expenditures in a way that makes those now more apparent. So in FY25, we can see that both Department of Corrections and Department of Family and Community Services overspent their UGF. Based on audited figures, unaudited figures, that's $12.6 million in FY25 and $0.7 million in DOC, $0.7 million in DFCS. And so these are expected to come to the legislature in future ratification requests, which is kind of permission to bless their overspending. So again, where we see overall less lapse, some of that is that there's also kind of the overspend that has to come out of somewhere from the general fund.
Okay, slide 9.
Okay, so going on to the supplemental, we've just heard a lot about this, so I'm not going to go into this since we already went over this. I would just note, you know, the fire suppression, that next week the governor should come out with a updated number that includes spring costs and potentially refines that amount from the earlier disasters. And then the governor's disaster language is essentially a fixed dollar amount. The issue with a fixed dollar amount is if oil goes down more than is projected, or you know, some estimated to be appropriation turns out to be more than the estimate, it doesn't get covered by that language. So going on to the revenue forecast, I realize the clock I've been looking at for time has stopped, so I shouldn't look at that one for time. But the fall revenue forecast shows lower oil prices in both FY26 and 27 than the spring revenue forecast. It shows lower production FY26, but higher production FY27 than the previous forecast. You can see that in the tables on the right. Lease expenditures, which are deducted in the production tax calculation, are also up, although... because we the lower price projection, all of the companies are now projected to hit the floor. There's a 4% gross floor. Some companies go below the floor because the gross value reductions can actually, as they call it, say, pierce the floor. So if you did a calculation of the total production and then a 4% gross, you'd get a higher number than the actual projection because of some companies paying below the floor. So not all of these lease expenditures actually are going against our revenue because they just bring us to the floor and no more. Petroleum corporate income tax projections are down more than you'd expect just based on price. And that seems to be based on kind of global factors from what Department of Revenue has said. And the result of that is that the revenue is lower than in FY26 and 27 by more than what the price change from the previous forecast alone would suggest. You know, when you look at the sensitivity tables that the Department of Revenue prepares, the actual reduction of revenue is greater than what that sensitivity table from the spring would have suggested.
Okay. Slide 11.
So another factor in our revenue picture is the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska revenue. And I'm going to spend a couple of slides on this because I think it's an important issue. It's not hugely material in the FY26 or FY27 revenue picture. In the long-term revenue projection, the amounts are pretty significant. So federal royalties from leases in the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska historically have been split 50-50 between the state and the federal government. There's federal law that requires the state give priority to use of these funds for the subdivisions most directly or severely impacted by the development, and those are communities within the North Slope that are impacted by NPRA development. That was litigated about 40 years ago, and when the state did not have kind of a grant program for that. And the result of that litigation was the creation of the NPRA grant program that's in statute. Appropriations to that program are made annually in the capital budget. Usually we do an estimated amount based on what actually comes in. The communities then go to the Department of Commerce, submit grant applications, and then the grants go out to those communities. So H.R. 1, or the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, or OBBBA, whatever you want to call it, changed that royalty split to 70-30 for leases issued after July 2025, but that change wasn't effective until 2034. And so over the fall, we in Ledge Finance and the Department of Revenue talked a little bit about whether the H.R. 1 also changed anything about the requirement that those be split with or prioritized to the local governments. And so I requested a legal opinion from Legislative Legal back in November that essentially confirmed Ledge Legal's opinion, H.R. 1 did not amend the revenue sharing requirement. So in their opinion, there's still a requirement that we share with communities first. And then, you know, talking to the Department of Revenue, there seemed to be some maybe ambiguity about whether starting in FY34 that was the case or not, but Ledge Legal didn't see any reason why there'd be any ambiguity before 2034. I mean, I see there's a question, but I have another slide on the same topic, so I'd rather get through that if I could before we do questions.
Let's go to slide 12 and take up questions from Stamp and Hannon.
Then in the fall revenue sources book, there was a change where none of the NPRA revenue starting in FY27 is classified as federal revenue. Now it's classified as general fund revenue, and then amounts restricted for the permanent fund and public school trust fund. And the governor's capital budget does not include the typical appropriation of the NPRA grant program. His operating budget does, however, include language that's in there every year that appropriates any lapsing appropriations, meaning anything that's not appropriated for the grants, is appropriated first to the permanent fund up to 25% of total revenue, then to the public school trust fund up to 0.5%, and then to the PCE endowment. So the governor is calling this UGF, but is still putting it in these funds, so none of it is actually reducing the deficit, which OMB's fiscal summary initially, I'm not sure if they changed it now, did not reflect those appropriations, and so their fiscal summary, in our view, was off by $9.6 million because they did not show the amount going into PCE that they said was UGF. Our reports in Ledge Finance still count the NPRA revenue as federal revenue because that's what Legislative Legal's belief is, and we go by their interpretation. And so we kind of have a difference between our fiscal summary and OMB's of that $9.6 million UGF and then the other amounts. And this table on the bottom shows the kind of cumulative impact of that difference. So when you ask Ledge Finance for a long-term look at the revenue, we're counting NPRA revenue as federal revenue for all the years, whereas the official revenue forecast counts a portion of it as UGF. And so that means we just have a difference of opinion about how that's going to go, and we're relying on advice from our legal counsel. So with that, I'll pause for the questions.
On outside legal counsel or?
On our legal counsel, Legislative Legal.
But they've already given you an opinion.
Right. So we believe that it's federal.
I see.
Yeah, based on that opinion.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank Coacher Justin through the chair to Director Painter. So a couple items. I would love to get my hands on that legal opinion. If you could share it, I don't know if it would be okay, prudent to give it to the committee. Approval, Chair.
Sounds like that's all right.
Follow up, Mr. Coacher.
Follow up, Representative
Stack. Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the Chair, Director Painter. I had some questions, obviously, for OMB when they presented this before me. I really do not like this for a lot of reasons. In the revenue sources book, it shows the fund source of the NPRA money is unrestricted general funds. That's not my interpretation. I'm glad you have a legal memo that says the same interpretation. And I'm really curious as to the argument, if you could maybe articulate it to the best of your knowledge from the administration on how they arrived at this conclusion. Because when I asked them the other day, I could not follow the logic through the chair.
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I have not seen any legal analysis, so I really can't speculate about the reasoning.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. First, Mr. Painter, just so it's on the record, because we're going from a 50-50 split to a 70-30, so can you affirm who's 70, who's 30?
Mr. Painter.
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, 70% to the state, which would be first the communities and then the state, and then 30 for the federal government.
Thank you. Follow up.
Representative Hannon, follow up.
And now my question is that is OMB using a 70% take from that starting now in FY26 or not until FY34?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the Department of Revenue is assuming that the 70-30 does not start until FY34.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair, I'm actually going to compare. I have a question about page 8 and 12 together. So you said that in the statute, this is with regard to the NPRA revenue. I appreciate that the lapsing funds first go to permanent fund and public school trust fund, et cetera, PCA. Is this assuming that, I guess what I'm asking is, does that mean we don't have any guidelines or anything in statute when there is an overspend, like filling that hole first? Right, we have $8 million of an overspend from DOC.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, so the NPRA lapsing funds are specifically, it's not general funds that are designated, just the NPRA funds are designated for those purposes in statute, not for general overspend.
Is there anything in statute that helps us recover when we do have an overspend from GF? Like this, this particular, it sounds like it was $8 million, and this time it's $12.6 million from straight out just overspend from DOC. So do we have anything that says if we have, extra funds that didn't get spent over here, it goes there? Is there anything that helps recover this hole?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, when there's an overspend that's been identified, usually through the audit process, it comes to the legislature as a ratification, which essentially is us blessing retroactively the spending in order to clear the audit finding.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Painter, if our leg legal's interpretation is correct, then in FY32, Nuiqsut, for example, and other impacted villages would have an enormous windfall of capital dollars for projects within their boundaries?
Mr. Chairman, yes, assuming they can spend all the entire amount, yes.
Okay. All right. I think we're ready to go to slide 13. We'll probably try to get through half the deck.
Sure. All right, Mr. Chairman, so slide 13 illustrates the percent of market value draw calculation. This is our largest source of revenue, so I think it's worth the slide. We talk so much about oil, but this is, again, our largest source of general fund revenue. So in FY26, the POMV draw is based on the balances from FY20 through 24. That results in about $3.8 billion. You notice that in FY27, we're dropping FY20, which is $64.9 billion, and then adding FY21, 81 point, or adding FY25, which is $84.7 billion. So the result of dropping that low year, adding a high year, means that the POMV draw is going to increase by nearly $200 million, which is definitely helpful for the FY27 budget situation. But as this table can kind of illustrate, we should not expect that to continue because there was such a huge jump in FY21. And so we've been seeing the last few years the POMV draw going up by more than is sort of over, you know, long-term expectation because we're incorporating that big jump. This is our last year incorporating that big jump. We're not getting big jumps again unless we have an amazing market one of these years. So, you know, when we're looking at the budget, FY27 is going to be easier than FY28 for a number of reasons because FY28 we won't have that big jump in the POMV draw.
Okay. Let's go to slide 14.
So, Mr. Chairman, the next few slides go through the adjusted base, which is sort of our process of taking last year's budget and getting to a clean starting point for the next year's budget. So we take last year's budget, and then we remove one-time appropriations, add statewide decisions such as policy salary adjustments and formula changes that are needed to maintain services at a status quo level. And a couple of years ago, working with the Office of Management and Budget, We modified our rules a little bit to include the formula changes to try to really make it clear what's a policy choice by the governor versus what's a formulaic change. So if the student count changes, that's not the governor cutting education. It's just the student count is different or increasing education if it goes up. And so now with these rules, it's easier to see his policy choices. It does mean adjusted base is a little more complex sometimes to go through. And one thing I would note is that when we have a formula item that's funded at a partial amount, like the PFD, we carry that formula forward into the next year's adjusted base. Because otherwise, if you start with the statute, then every year the adjusted base would say, we need to pay the municipal property tax exemption that we haven't paid since the 90s. We just go based on the current policy from the previous year. So the first thing we do is remove one-time items. There is a minor error in this slide where the amounts for the Department of Law, Statehood Defense, and the DEC PFAS amounts are reversed. We'll correct that in the other body's version of this presentation tomorrow. But the totals are fine. So a lot of these items originated in FY25 or previous years and are carried forward. And the amounts here represent the balances that were carried forward rather than the original amount. So essentially the first step to getting to the clean starting point is we remove $31.6 million of one-time or expiring items.
Okay. I think we're going to stop there. But you said on slide 15, Statehood Defense and DEC PFAS are reversed.
Yes.
So we should make that.
Mr. Chairman, yes. And I'll get a corrected version to the committee.
And right, and you've noted the PFD in LFD's definition has an adjusted base of $1,000.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. All right. I think that we've made it halfway through this deck. Mr. Painter, I'm glad you live in Juneau and work across the street. We will have my staff find a time that is convenient for you. That's important to complete this important document. With that, that concludes our business for today. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, January 27th at 1:30. At that meeting, Department of Labor and Workforce Development will give two presentations. First, they will give their FY27 departmental budget overview. Second, they'll present on the statewide 2026 jobs forecast and unemployment insurance financing metrics. With that, we will adjourn this meeting at 3:27. Thank you.